I'm delighted to be here today with Rafe Kelly, who is the founder of Evolve Move Play, which is a very interesting organization, and he has a podcast by the same name. And Rafe and I are both designated speakers at an upcoming conference called Estuary Northwest 2024, which is September 12th through the 15th. And the founder of that conference wanted us all to talk to each other so we could kind of lay some groundwork as to where our overlaps are in terms of our ideas. And one of the places where I thought that we might have an overlap is in this idea that maintaining the strength and capacity of the human body requires a blend of love and sacrifice. And I say love because maintaining your body allows you to love not only yourself, but others in the way that you have more capacity to serve. Mm-hmm. And obviously there's a certain amount of sacrifice in being able to take on the opportunity cost of the things that you need to do to maintain your body today so that you don't have bad consequences tomorrow. So yep. Maybe you could just spring out from there and we could just to talk about that. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. What I do is essentially a combination of physical practices and dialogical practices that are oriented towards helping people cultivate wisdom and virtue. And we really focus on the body, one, because we live in a culture with a mind-body duality. And we don't recognize that actually that's not the... I don't think that duality particularly works. And once we collapse it, we realize that in order to feed the whole system, in order to connect, we have to start in the body. So love, right? Love is an experience that we have. It's an emotion. So we can talk about love as a physical experience, right? You look at a child, you know, your child, and you pick them up and something happens inside you and your face moves in a specific way and, you know, whatever it is, you know, we can, I think it's funny in our culture, we tend to reach for neurobiology, right? It's oxytocin and dopamine and whatever. But we don't experience oxytocin and dopamine, we experience love, but love is a physical thing, right? When you pick up your child, you have an urge to kiss the top of their head. You have an urge to stroke them, an urge to hug them, right? These are physical expressions. Now, when we live lives that are extremely abstracted away from our physicality, we become less and less sensitized to those very phenomenological, sensual experiences of the body that are telling us what it is to actually experience love, what it is to act in love, what it is to feel love for somebody. And so when we reinvest ourselves in the body, we discover all the layers of the self and the capacity that we have to relate and relate to ourselves, relate to the world itself, and relate to others. And indeed, I think to relate to the transcendent. And it does require sacrifice, right? There's, you know, a deeply realized physical practice involves some kind of struggle. It involves some kind of, you don't get to be strong without work, without some level of discomfort. But when you have that strength, then you can throw that child in the air and you can bring joy to that child. When you have strength, you can offer that to the people around you. And so that capacity for strength that comes through sacrifice is a gift that you then have to give in love to all the people around you. And ultimately, that's the best, in my opinion, that is the ultimate thing to be oriented to, that gives meaning to whatever physical practice is that we take on, is that they allow us to more effectively fall in love with our experience of being and then to act in love in how we move through that experience.
So is there a danger inherent in that? It seems that for some people, this physical prowess leads to a deep self-love that actually shuts out other people. Have you run into that issue?
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. I think that every potential transformative practice, for me, I've always seen that there is a there's a downside, right? So I remember encountering this this idea occurred to me first in actually looking at the practice of concentration meditation or Vipassana, right? So, you know, that's a huge, there's a huge emphasis on mindfulness right now in our culture. It's very popular. There's many apps that are about mindfulness. Everyone is doing mindfulness retreats and mindfulness this and mindfulness that. And one of the foundational practices that most people do is a seated concentration meditation on their breath. And everyone was sort of treating this as a panacea, right? And your depression is going to go away. You're going to do better. You're going to be able to handle all these things better. But I started running into lots of people who I experienced as being emotionally deadened through their experiences of Vipassana. They were unable to actually connect to their own emotions because of what had happened to Vipassana. I started talking to people who'd gone on, you know, 7-day silent retreats and had people go have psychotic breaks. It's like, okay, well, it is a powerful practice. It really can work in the right context, in the right, you know, for the right person. But it's not a panacea. It is dangerous when a person is not properly prepared and they don't have the right ecology of practices around it. Now, we see the same thing with parkour, right? Parkour is kind of the base practice from which all of my stuff really spun up, along with the deep background in martial arts that preceded that. But parkour inherently is an encounter with fear. A lot of what we do in parkour is scary. And so you can cultivate courage in a very dramatic way through the practice of parkour. It really allows you to relate to your mind in how it experiences fear at a very deep level and learn to become skillful in your response to fear. So many people in the community who started parkour with me, they talked about the idea that parkour was incredibly transformative, right? It was like this, and it was like our religion. It really was when we were all starting. And everyone's talking about it. But then I started to observe that not everyone's actually exhibiting the transformations that they say this is about, right? So it's like, oh, you're super courageous, but you're actually really cowardly because in the way that you, like, maybe you can't go talk to a girl that you're attracted to, or
I was wondering about that. Does it transfer out into the social realm? Yeah,
it can, but it doesn't always. And it's sort of like a thing that I think that you can kind of go two ways with it. One is you start to, you know, to use a John Vervaeke kind of approach, it reciprocally opens you up and you start to see that, oh, I can apply this process in all these other places. But it can also become a place of reciprocal narrowing. And this is the same thing with Vipassana, where you say, I feel really courageous when I do parkour. So I can just tell myself that I'm courageous because I do this, even though I'm actually behaving cowardly over there. So it can become a place of that where you can go to get a false signal of your courage that's not actually transferring, right? And I see people go into this really intense reciprocal narrowing around Vipassana as well, or yoga, where they feel so able to kind of move away from their mental demons when they're in this state, but they're not transferring it out. So they become more and more dependent on it, more and more seeking of this place where they can go quiet their mind, but they're not able to quiet their mind. And they become more fragile to the ups and downs of everyday life. So I think that...
Is that because the one thing, whether it's parkour or the meditation practice, that becomes the center of your life so that you don't have a higher center? Is that, would you say that would be the reason?
Yeah, I think there's kind of two. I think there's two pieces to understanding that. One is this thing that I think fundamentally we actually need some kind of ecology of practices where we have practices that help us reflect on and see our practice from another perspective and that reciprocally reinforce the adaptations. So something like parkour and Vipassana actually are really interesting in combination because we can really feel our ability to concentrate shift in a practice like parkour specifically from that. So we see a transfer of practice between those two things. A mindfulness practice improves our capacity for entering the flow state. And so we can see these two things. It creates a laboratory for whether you're actually getting the effect of your mindfulness practice. And then in some sense, it's like parkour is like, I would think of it as a local game, right? It's a game that's a constrained aspect of reality. It's not all of reality. And Vipassana is the same thing. It's a local game, but there's some meta game that's the set of all games. And ultimately what we're trying to address with our practices is to become more adaptive in the meta game. But every game that we play, whether it's parkour or Vipassana or football or basketball or skiing or, you know, whatever it is, you know, Toastmasters, stand-up comedy, all of these things are local games. And we can become so addicted to winning in the local game that we actually start to make sacrifices in the meta game in order to continue progress in the local game.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of these sort of subcultures that develop around the practices, they actually kind of want to reward you for that. They tend to, because we as a culture just don't actually have a very good container to orient people towards the idea of the metagame at all. Because we've rejected the meta narrative, we've rejected the whole idea of, you know, overarching meta narratives and a transcendent good. So if there's no higher good that's out there, then why would you choose to do anything other than optimize for whatever local good happens to be salient to you in any given moment?
Well, so let's talk about that higher good a little bit later. Right now, I'm curious about the whole thing about mindfulness practices. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about a particular kind of meditation. Vipassana? Mm-hmm. Is that the right way to say it?
Vipassana. It's called Vipassana.
Vipassana. Yeah. Okay. Now, does that also, it seems odd to me that that could result in the kind of consequences you're describing, because I would assume as a mindfulness practice that it's trying to train you to be in the now. So that each moment becomes more fruitful, becomes more real to you. Would that be the purpose of the mindfulness practice of Vipassana, or does it have a different purpose?
I can't speak too much to Vipassana because I'm not. I've learned the basics of the mm-hmm. concentration practice from that tradition. It's come down through the teachers that I've worked with, but I've never gone super deep into that tradition and sort of the overarching philosophical container that it's within. I can only speak as somebody who's observed people who've done it and noticed a trend, right? And at the risk of trying to condense a very rich tradition into a very simplistic format, there's an element to me in that kind of Eastern tradition, that the Indian tradition, the Indian spiritual tradition, because Vipassana, you know, comes, I think, from Vedanta, or it's often oriented towards a kind of escape from the suffering of this world. And emotion is often seen as trapping us in attachment. And so there's a way in which we can be trying to move away from emotion that I think is ultimately not fruitful and can be quite harmful to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we can use concentration meditation to access flow states and to improve our present mindedness. But mm-hmm. when we approach it with this idea that we're in some sense escaping our capacity to be attached to this world, I think when that's treated carelessly, and especially when we're moving between cultural containers, I think a lot of people are entering practices that come from Vedanta or that come from Buddhism, that come from Taoism as Westerners, and they don't have the kind of cultural antecedents to fully understand what they're entering into. Mm-hmm. I think that makes it potentially more dangerous.
So do you have other practices that you do that help you to maintain yourself in the now, in the moment? I'm not speaking of flow state. I'm speaking of like, even being able to conduct, well, you do a podcast, so you have to be able to be in the now when you're talking to people and listening to them, right? And just in relationships, whether it's marital relationships or with your children, to be able to cultivate that appreciation, the gratitude for the now.
Your nowness. I wouldn't say that I have a particular practice that's precisely focused on that, but I think that many of the practices all end up rooting down to that, because if you practice parkour and your mind wanders away from the moment, you get smacked down, right? Like most of the falls that I took early on in my parkour training were because my mind would shift. Sometimes it would actually just get distracted by very random things. I'd be in the middle of a sequence and I would have an intrusive thought and I would fall down. But a lot of times it was actually because within a sequence of movements, there would be one that was particularly difficult and my mind would shift to trying to control that movement too early in the sequence. And I would lose touch with the thing that needed to be done in this moment. Mm-hmm. And so parkour is actually a really profound embodied experience of the necessity of attending to what is present in the moment. Mm-hmm. We also do dialogical practices. We've done practices that come from the circling tradition and from the authentic relating tradition. And we've had John Verveke come and do dialectic into dialogos with us and philosophical fellowship. And all of that, I'm not an adept in any of those, but I've adopted and started to practice those things, or elements that arise for them, or sort of insights that arise from them, have become very salient to me in how I conduct my relationship with my wife and how I show up for my children. And a lot of that is, again, it's about sort of not allowing yourself to get too much into a forward story or a backward story, but say, okay, this is what I'm in right now. This is how I'm feeling in this moment. This is what I'm noticing from you in this moment. I'm not going to get too much into a story about where it comes from, but just experience it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really good. So for the people who are coming to my channel who aren't familiar with what you do, would you happen to be able to share one of your videos of you leaping through the forest?
Would you like me to like go?
They're so amazing. I allowed you to share a screen. So if you have one handy, I saw one, I think that you had posted on Facebook where you're leapfrogging over trees in the woods. And it's so amazing to watch. It's just impossible to believe that humans are capable of that. So the kind of body work that you're doing is helping people to develop a capacity that looks very little short of magic to people who are on the outside.
Thank you. Sorry. I turned my video off instead of sharing my screen. Share. Here we go.
Now, if it's going to have sound, you might notice on the share button to... go ahead and try. We'll see if it works.
Yeah. Share your computer.
Have Zoom audio. It'll probably work even without Zoom audio.
So this is one of our retreats.
Been an incredible journey of exploring.
I'll switch it because that one has a bunch of people talking. So I'll show you this one instead.
This is the one I was thinking of. So do you do other kinds of workout besides this in order to be able to do this? Do you also need like weightlifting and running and all of those kinds of things to prepare for this?
Yes, I do. You know, it is a very powerful athletically developed practice in itself, but it's good to vary what you do. So fundamentally, we think that essentially you need to work on practices that involve
oh my god
the way that you move your body in relationship to itself and making sure all the joints function, are healthy, all the systems play well together, including the emotional and cognitive systems. And then we got to be able to move things around in the world too, tools, and we got to be able to move with other people. And we can focus that on a skill level, or we can focus that in the level of the development of physical attributes. So I'll use something like a barbell or a kettlebell, or a rope, or any number of things to specifically address development of different traits that help me with these skills.
Wow, that's just so beautiful.
Thank you.
So, when you do retreats with people, do you have a requirement that they have a certain physical level before they join the retreat? Because it seems like it would be dangerous if you weren't, if you didn't have the physical capacity.
We have the ability to scale extremely well. So we take groups of up to 25, and we'll have three coaches plus a couple of apprentices who are helping us. And then we'll go into an area, and we will have a plan that involves basically scaled versions of challenges based on the physical level of the students that we have. So John Bervaeke was one of our students in 2002, 2022. So we've had students into their 60s, students of all levels of physical ability, both, you know, elite parkour and martial arts athletes, as well as, you know, professors who are, you know, just a few years from retirement.
Do you mostly do this in the Pacific Northwest?
So our retreats have been primarily taught in the Pacific Northwest. We've done one out in Europe, and then we actually have our first one on the East Coast coming up in mid-September. So that's a week after Estuary in Vermont. That'll be taught by two of my students. And then going into next year, we'll very likely have retreats in Europe and possibly in Australia as well.
And how often do you do the retreats?
So we have three in so spring, summer, and fall here in the States. And then potentially going into next year, we'll be looking at a winter retreat somewhere like Costa Rica, Hawaii. And then, in future years, we'll probably have maybe three on the East Coast, three on the West Coast, three in Europe, et cetera, stuff like that.
So is this your whole career, or do you have a day job besides
this? This is my day job. This is my day job. I have we have an online academy as well. So we're going to be doing like an online coaching cohort coming up at the end of September. We'll have 6 weeks where we'll be taking people through the foundations of our practices. And so we have a bunch of online courses, but we're moving from primarily doing online courses to primarily doing these coaching courses, because we're finding that people just need a little bit more, personal touch from coaches in order to really get themselves through the practice. It's very hard to buy a program and watch a bunch of videos and then go to do it on your own. So being able to have a coach who you meet once a week, get to talk to, get to ask your questions of, who's going to follow up with you, we think is going to be a much more productive model for actually getting people to fully experience the practice.
So you also have some sort of a strategy for multiplying yourself, developing more leaders to have these conferences or these retreats all over the place?
Yeah, so we're kind of, I've had a few sort of informal apprentices over the years who've kind of just done a lot of work with me. So the first person who I certified to teach under my method was, his name is Ben Metter. He teaches in London, and he did a year of online personal coaching with me, and he came to Return to the Source, and I went over and he co-taught with me for a couple of workshops over in Europe. So after that, I felt comfortable. He had a very extensive experience. And I had two students here in the United States who were training with me like weekly and coming to all the retreats, and they became coaches. And so I've been doing that informally for a period of time, but just this year we started a formal apprenticeship. And so I have 10 students right now who are going through a year long intensive with me. So they meet with me twice a week. online to basically go through. I'll show you the stack of books I'm teaching based off of. So we've got Margaret Stryker, Reshaping Physical Education is a book from the 1930s, How We Learn to Move by Rob Gray, who's an ecological dynamics based motor learning researcher at the ASU. We've got Dynamics in Action by Alicia Hararo, Ecological Psych, the Ecological Approach to Visual Perception by J.J. Gibson, and Dexterity in Its Development by Nicolai Bernstein.
Okay, so go back a second. You said Dynamics in Action by Alicia Hararo.
Yeah.
Isn't she the one that she's a scientist. I've got one of her books on complexity, I think.
Yep, she's a complexity scientist, and yeah, that's a recommendation from John. I haven't fully dug into that one yet, so that's something I'm also still learning and working
And then
on.
also the J.J. Gibson book.
Yep.
I've dug into that quite a bit for talking to various people, especially Wolfgang Smith. He was very high on Gibson and what
Gibson's yeah, Gibson's work I think is incredibly profound, and particularly in the space. I was talking to John yesterday about we've been talking about the idea that the ecological psychology model actually presupposes a kind of Platonic realism, and it's actually a really profound argument. The effectiveness of ecological psychology and ecological approaches is actually a pretty profound argument for a Platonic realist approach to universals. That's an argument that I don't feel super prepared to go super deep on. It's just something that I've been like, huh. Another book that John had me read is Platonism and the Objects of Science. So I just finished that relatively recently. Actually, interestingly, John told me to read that because of certain sticking points that Jonathan Peugeot and I got to in our discussions of sort of the religious worldview versus the rational materialist worldview. And it was extremely helpful. And Jonathan and I had a really incredible conversation that ended up not getting recorded.
Oh man, that's too bad. Because I've talked with Michael Levin a number of times, and he works with this whole idea of morphogenesis. And he, over the last 4 or 5 years, has come more and more to this idea that he wouldn't call it an ecological perspective, but it has to be basically that the environment actually trains the organism. So the organism is moving into the environment, and the organism is always searching, or parts of the organism are always searching the available morpho space of form. So there has to be some sort of space of forms that things move into. And what was the name of that book again that you just read? Because I would be very interested in that one.
Platonism and the Object of Science by Morris
Wait.
Berman.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, I mean, if you look back at the evolutionary history of animals, what you'll see is that certain body plans reoccur over and over again. So there have been four-legged pursuit predators with relatively long snouts, which is a wolf-like thing, in many, many different iterations, many different sort of small coyote-like creatures have then evolved into large hyper-predatory wolf-like creatures. That's happened over and over again. We see the same thing in the cat lineage and various offsprings of the cat lineage turning into saber-toothed animals with large saber teeth. But we can see the same thing then happening in marsupials with Thylacosimilus. We can even go back to Gorgonopsids and find the same thing. So there's a solution space that organisms can apply to, and it's dependent on this environment, right? Like, how much wing loading can a creature have before it's too heavy to fly? Well, that depends on gravity and the atmosphere. So in a different type of environment, that a different type of atmosphere, a different level of gravity, then we can have a very different sort of set of body plans available. But there is a set of body plans that are available on Earth, and we see, a repetition over and over again. Another really, and we see convergent evolution, right? Thylacines and wolves, or termites, right? Most people don't realize termites are not ants. They're cockroaches. Termites evolved from the cockroach lineage. So they're not
Absolutely disgusting.
part.
Because in
Yeah.
California, we have termites everywhere. So to
Yes.
imagine that
Just
your house
flying,
has actually been
cockroaches.
permeated by flying cockroaches is pretty disgusting.
Yes, it is, but it's also incredible and fascinating because bees, wasps, and ants are the primary eusocial insects, and they, we think they developed eusociality early on in their lineage, and then we have secondarily non-eusocial, like parasitic wasps and things like that. But termites come from a completely different lineage and evolve the same exact thing. So again, you have this form of a eusocial insect, and a termite ends up looking like an ant, even though it's not. There's another really crazy example of this. Sorry, I'm a huge biology geek, so you've ticked one of my weird boxes. But there are something like seven different lineages, I believe, of crustaceans that have evolved into crabs. So when we see an animal that is a crab, it doesn't necessarily closely relate it to some other animal that is a crab. A crab is a body plan that has been adopted over and over again from similar antecedents. It's so common in the fossil record that there's a name for it. It's called carcinization, the process by which crustaceans become crabs. And so that points to something like a form, right? There's a, like, from an ecological perspective, you could say that there's like a, yeah, a morpho space that's out there that has specific solutions that are like big valleys in the search space that organisms are going to fall into over and over and over again.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that Levin is always talking about is how many times when you're working in mathematics or physics or anything else, you can determine the first two-thirds of a solution, and the third part of the solution will just fall out of that. You don't need to go all the way to the end because there's a certain part of it that's given. It's like given to you. It's a gift that's offered. He, on a very simple level, he uses the explanation of if you have two lines with a certain angle, you don't have to think up what where that third line is going to go. It automatically, you know that those angles are going to add up to 180 degrees. So it's a given. Those angles are a given. It can't be any other way and still be a triangle.
A square
But
plus four equals
that
zero.
truth scales up into a lot of much more complex problems. Not, all of which are not at the tip of my tongue right now, but it is that idea that there are certain solutions that are somehow written into the system.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing there. Yeah.
Yeah, he's always saying, like, where does that stuff come from? So, for example, when a creature that has two, I can't think of the biological term right now, has two sides, left arm, right arm,
Bilateral system.
bilateral. We have a bilateral system, and the organism is developing out of the zygote or whatever is, in humans it would be the zygote. As the arms are growing, how do they know when to stop so that they're both equal? The fingers are growing. How do they know when to stop so that they're equal, so that you have equal on both sides, because that is not written into the DNA. It's nowhere in the DNA. So he has studied a lot in the area of electrical and biochemical communication amongst cells, that they're talking to each other. But even there, once it gets into the bilateral thing, there's too much distance between the sides for there to be that kind of communication going on. So where is the subroutine that tells them when to stop? And that's part of what drives his research. He's always thinking about stuff like that, but then he doesn't think the real high flown abstract stuff. He thinks about what kind of an experiment could I do that could give me another piece of information about this? So he's always bringing it back down really to what we would call the embodied world, right?
Yeah, or the empirical, right?
Yeah. What can be actually done in the world, in the system of reality, not just what you would imagine or hope to be, but what actually is.
Karen, do you mind if we pause for a second?
Oh, not at all.
Sorry, my wife is trying to reach me and I'm like, I'm worried about why. Hey, Beth.
So part of our journey here is to learn about each other so that we will be better able to do. I don't know whether we'll get one of these matchup conversations at the conference or not, but I think they are planning to have each person speak and then have them talk to each other. And so who knows how that'll all go, but just so we can kind of figure out where our ideas overlap and how we both ended up in this corner.
Yeah,
that would be a good question to ask you. How did you end up talking in this little corner of the internet? Was it through John Verbeke?
I suppose. So
or did
I
talked to Paul first.
So I became very interested in Jordan Peterson in 2016. So after he appeared on the Joe Rogan podcast, and of course. You know, I was interested in the political stuff that he was talking about with Bill C-16. But once he got into his maps of meaning stuff, I got really, really interested because at the time I was really just actually digging into the idea of how meaning like was actually motivated physical practice. And I was really especially interested in the question of narrative. I was noticing that I was very scientifically literate and I would share scientific findings to justify the ways that we practice to the students that I worked with. And I noticed that that didn't have nearly the same kind of impact on them as when I told personal stories about the practice or what was emotionally meaningful to me. And so I could see that there was a kind of mode that I could enter that was more autobiographical poet that seemed to really, really land with students much more than being able to sort of cite statistics or a kind of specific research perspectives. And so I was really curious about what made a story work. And so when I started to dig into Peterson, I was like, okay, here's these grand archetypal stories. And I started to actually tell the story of, you know, like the dragon slayer archetype as a way of explaining what we were doing when we approached a movement practice. So if you think about the classic sort of call to adventure, the sort of the hero's journey, right? There's a call to adventure. There's a descent into the underworld, a confrontation with chaos. You bring back the elixir, right? You have to deal with fear. So within parkour, we talk about this idea of breaking the jump. So breaking the jump, you basically feel the first thing that they talk about is you feel the call of the jump. You see a jump and it calls to you. It says, okay, this is possible for you. So it's call to adventure, call the jump. And then the next thing you do is that if it's a real jump, if it's challenging, you feel fear. So you have to deal with your fear. So that's kind of like our descent to the underworld, right? And you have to confront it. You have to deal with your fear. And eventually you do the jump. It's like your confrontation with the dragon. And on the other side of it, you feel really good. You're really excited. Right? That's some kind of reward. And then ultimately it's like you grow in character, you grow in capacity. And then you get excited about it and you say, hey guys, come try this jump. It's a great jump. And you bring back the elixir. So in those maps, I found something that was really like really in common. And then looking at Jordan's model of understanding the neurobiology of approach and play. And my wife actually had done her master's thesis on parkour as a form of adult play. And she got really into the research on Jean Piaget and Jacques Panksepp. And so I had encountered those people through her and through the work of another thinker named Frank Ferencich. But in Jordan, I then went really deep into, you know, going and reading all the stuff about rough and tumble play, which I'd already been teaching. And it was just so aligned for me. So I got super fascinated by Jordan. I went really, really deep into his work. I met him in 2017, invited him on my podcast at the time. And he said yes, but then it fell through. And then the Kathy Newman interview happened, and then Jordan's star was just ascended so fast. It was like impossible to catch up with him. So I don't recall if I spoke to Paul before I spoke to John. I think that when John came out, I saw the same kind of potential in John that Jordan had, and I was like, I'm not missing my opportunity. So 7 episodes into Waiting for the Meaning Crisis, I was already reaching out to John, and we had an incredible conversation right from the start, and John wanted to stay connected. And so I started talking to John every couple months, pretty much for the last 5 years. Then somewhere in that, I think maybe Paul saw me talking to John and recognized that we had this common understanding of Jordan, and we started maybe just like talking on Twitter. And then eventually I went on his channel. And then I started to get other invites to other channels on this little corner of the internet and have stayed abreast of things. I'm not a someone who's super dialed into all the little channels that are in this corner.
It's impossible to keep up.
It's difficult to keep up. Yeah, like I follow John's work really closely. I dip in and out of Jonathan and Paul at different times, and same for Jordan now. Like I don't keep up with Jordan's podcast unless it's something that's specific to what I'm doing. But then, like recently, I've been consuming some of Brendan Graham Dempsey because the questions around metamodern spirituality and Christianity have been really relevant to me. I had Savilla King on my channel, and I read Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance and got into that. And so, yeah, that's kind of how I became a figure in this little corner.
So we could talk a minute about Brendan Graham Dempsey and what it was that you found in his work that was interesting to you. And the reason that I'm fascinated with that right at this moment is that maybe a month or two ago, I got a request from a young man who had written a book about archdisciplinarity. And he wanted to know if he could come on and talk about it. The whole idea of archdisciplinarity is that there is something that goes above and beyond all the various disciplines in that and I mean, I've been talking about this thing for 5 years, how everything scales. And so all of these truths, you find a truth in any one discipline, you're going to find that same truth in another discipline. It might be at a different scale, but it's going to be the same truth. And so he'd written this book about not only you have the discipline and then you have the interdisciplinary and then you have the meta-disciplinary, but then above the meta-disciplinary, there's this thing they're calling archdisciplinarity. And one of the co-authors on that book is Brendan Graham Dempsey. So I thought, well, I should have been listening to Brendan Graham Dempsey to see what he's all about, but maybe you can give me a heads up.
So Brennan is someone who I think has done a lot of work to try to articulate something called metamodernism, which would be what comes after postmodernism. Because postmodernism, in some sense, it leaves us kind of without a direction, right? It sort of takes away the oars. And so metamodernism is like, well, we're sick of that, right? It's like, it's great. The insights are real and profound, and or some of them are, and we can't really go back, but all you're left with is nihilism.
Because
So
it
what
takes
comes
away the
next?
grand narratives and it takes away any sense of meaning.
So a variety of people over the years have pointed out the work that I'm doing and the way that I'm talking and told me that I'm a metamodernist. And I was like, I don't know exactly what that means. I've seen, I think that in the articulation of what comes after postmodernism, there's been this idea of integral, which comes from Ken Wilber and the people around him. There's the metamodern thing. And then there's a lot of other stuff that I think is sort of postmodern, and maybe doesn't exactly have a flag it flies under. But John, I would say, is very much a post-postmodern. Jordan is a post-postmodern. And so I think that Brennan's done a lot to articulate that, and then he's proposed recently, he's very interested in how that gets in contact with the spiritual, right? That in some sense, would say that modernism is very broken in its approach to spirituality. You can go all the way back to Descartes and see that, like, Descartes turns the world into a set of automations, right? John, I think, would talk about the idea of like a substance ontology, and that from this substance ontology, once we reach a certain point, we get this collapse of meaning and this sort of view of the world as automata. And then Descartes basically tries to rescue the mind and God by just saying, hey, I experience a mind and therefore it has to come from God. And since everything else is automata, well, then the mind can't be. And then we enter that mind-body duality. And then as science progresses, we end up in this place where science continues to sort of, at least at a surface level, explain more and more of what traditional religion tried to explain. And then you end up with this, like, this idea of the shrinking God of the gaps. And at a certain point, it's like, if neurobiology can show us, we at least have the ability to break brains in very interesting ways that say that, the mind appears to be related to matter in a really important way. And so then there's like potentially nothing left, right? Once people start saying that love is just a bunch of chemicals, there's no meaning left. And then I think my sense, and I think that this is what Brendan would say as well, and maybe Paul Einleitner and other people, is that there's a kind of branch of Christianity that sort of adopts the metamodern or the modernist ontological frame and just tries to turn Christianity into a competing story, but just one that a competing scientific story, but just one that's not very well justified. But we kind of reach a point where materialism doesn't work, and we end up that understanding that underneath it all is some sort of relational ontology, right? Some sort of process ontology. And quantum physics messes everything up, and now we're in a new place. And so we have postmodernism, which throws out all the grand narratives, and then we realize on the other side of that, well, we can't actually live without narratives. So we can't go back, but how do we do it, right? Paul Einleitner talked about this in one of his things, so I thought it was good. He was talking about a sort of modernist, postmodernist, and metamodern stories, right? So a modernist story would be kind of like he gave the example of Tim the Toolman Taylor, right? Morality is just clear and obvious, and every story sort of ends with a moral story. There's a conflict, and then there's a moral out the other. And then in the 90s, we hit things like Seinfeld, where actually there's no real good and bad in Seinfeld. Seinfeld is about nothing, right? It's about laughing at the absurdity of everything. And then he gives the example of everything, everywhere, all at once, which sort of takes us through this huge postmodernist conundrum of like, there's an infinite set of narratives that you could live within. But ultimately, the resolution is that you just choose a narrative and you live with it. The meaning comes when you decide that you're willing to accept a given narrative and to choose it. So that's a kind of where my brain is, I guess, in trying to
So that
process
everything, everywhere, all at once, you would describe as a metamodern movie.
at a modern film, yeah.
Yeah, because where I've heard the phrase most often is where people are talking about movies, and that the metamodern movie is one that is attempting to inject meaning back into a system where meaning has been ejected for a long time. So, but it has to be done with a certain amount of irony and a little bit of cynicism and. So they're still trying to maintain some of the postmodern ethos for people who need that in order to feel comfortable, but then they inject some meaning back into it. So like all of these narratives that are out there, and then you just pick one and because you're willing to make some meaning out of it. But it's still, your choice. Which narrative you pick is your choice, right?
Yeah, Paul was talking about this idea that, like, I was talking to John yesterday about the problem of pluralism, right? Like John was challenging me on my sort of choice to sort of begin to identify as a Christian, if that's what's happening. I feel like I'm in a very liminal space between Christianity and maybe, I don't know, maybe John's Zen Neoplatonism, but compared to John, I'm much more oriented towards the idea that we should be really cautious about our capacity to invent something better.
Yes.
And I've had some personal experiences in the last year with a sort of spiritual revelation that is related specifically to the figure of Christ that is pretty intense for me. So it's been happening for maybe 7 years or so that there's a kind of emotional call towards Christianity in me. But John and I were talking about that, and he was talking about the problem of pluralism, right? That when we live in a sort of mono religious system, then the question is sort of like whether you accept a religion or not. But Pascal's wager breaks down once you live in a system where there's Jews and Muslims and neo-pagans and Taoists and Buddhists and Vedanta and all of those things, right? It's like, well, how do you justify a specific religion as being what it is? And Paul was talking about this. It's like part of it is you just say, this is my tradition, right? Because I can't, it's very hard to justify that if I had been born and raised in Iran, that I would have had the same attraction to Christianity that I have now, right? Like, because I would have been raised in a different cultural context, right? Part of why I'm trying to understand Christianity is because I'm trying to understand where I come from and where my family comes from, and where my parents came from, where our culture comes from, like what makes the West the West. And if I grew up in the Islamic world or in China, that would be a very different question. So he was saying, like, I can recognize that, and I can still say I choose the Christian tradition anyways. And if I put my mind to it, I can come up with really good reasons why I'm a Christian and not those other things. But you still leave room for the fact that other perspectives exist and also have valid reasons for why they exist. So I don't know. I don't feel like I have a really, really beautiful model to offer you here. I'm more meandering around what I'm trying to
Well,
understand.
no, it's really interesting to me to see the way that you're working your way through this because it's a very honest path that you're on, and I really admire that.
Thank you.
I guess I'm a very simple person, and so I became a Christian when I was 32, and I've gone through a number of iterations of that process, but somehow I have never lost sight of Christ as being the ultimate reality. So what that says to me, if I just look at the world even through a scientific lens, there is something that is a reality that if you start poking at it the wrong way, you're going to get consequences. When you're leaping through the trees, if you lose your focus for a second, you're gonna crash and burn. One of the great Christian singers back in the early 1980s, when I had first become a Christian, he and two of his children, and four people who were visiting his ministry, got in a small plane so that they could fly over the property and look at the area of the property. And it happened to be a plane that was not calibrated for that much weight. And so the plane crashed and they all died. And it was It was a horrifying thing. And here was somebody that I admired so much and I had followed him. He was a wonderful teacher and a wonderful person. He left behind his wife who was pregnant with their child. And to look at all that, I'm a new Christian and I'm thinking, why would God let something like this happen? This is just too tragic. But the more that I think it through, the more that I think I'm thinking to myself back in 1982 or whenever that happened, a plane is supposed to carry so much weight. And if you put more weight in it than it can handle, that's a law of physics. It's going to come down. And there are certain things that are just laws of physics that you can't, you know, Jordan Peterson phrases it this way, you can't twist the fabric of reality and not expect it to bounce back at you.
Yeah.
Which indicates that there is some sort of reality. So what is that reality? I think that's what we're all trying to find, is what is that reality? And in all of the thinking and study and relationships and everything that I've been through in all of these years, as I've thought things through, and certainly Jordan Peterson's grand scope of philosophy and psychology and history and biology, chemistry, and all the things that I learned from listening to him. And then all the people that I've talked to in 5 years on my channel, this reality has a certain shape to it. And I think if you look at all of the other religions of the world, and then you look at Christianity and bring them together with that shape, the only one that fits that shape is Christianity. Now, I don't know what to make of that in a pluralistic society. But so you have the person who's born in Iran. Some people are born to Christian parents in Iran, but most people are born to Muslim parents in Iran. But there are, right now, there are hundreds of thousands of Muslims in the Middle East who are having some kind of a dream. And the
Millions.
dream reveals Christ to them, and they instantly become Christians.
Interesting.
My older daughter had wandered away from her Christian faith for a number of years. And about 6 months ago, she had a confrontation where she was just sitting there. And all of a sudden, it was that God just downloaded into her mind, into her heart, into her being, the truth of everything in less than 5 minutes. She wasn't seeking it. She wasn't looking for it. She wasn't asking for it. And it happened to her. And she was transformed in an instant.
Do you think
now, that doesn't happen for everybody? It didn't happen for me that way. You know, for me, it was a long period of searching and trying to understand.
Yeah. Do you think that those kinds of miracles are unique to Christianity, though? Right? Are there people? I mean, I know.
No,
people.
No. I don't think they're unique to Christianity at all. I'm just saying that it doesn't, in a certain sense, it doesn't. Just saying that there is a pluralistic society and that other people believe other things doesn't negate Christianity as being
No.
potentially what the truth
Sure.
is.
Yeah, I mean, we live in a pluralistic society about whether the earth is round or flat, right?
Well, I mean, there are some people that talk about a flat earth, but is that really, do you think that's a serious exploration of reality?
Not particularly. My point is that just because there's a variety of different beliefs doesn't mean that some of those beliefs are much better justified than others.
Oh, yes.
Right. So, you know, we don't have to always, you know, just treat all belief systems as of equivalent validity, right? But scientific empiricism seems to be, rational empiricism seems to be, we're able to talk right now across Zoom because these constructs are sufficiently valid to make the technologies work, right?
Yep.
And they've been done multiple times, many, many times. You know, they can be validated here and there and everywhere. And when we get into the realms of people's spiritual experiences, we got to things that are not as mutually validatable, right? The experience you talked about your daughter have is not one that you can elicit reliably in other people.
No, and you can't list it in yourself either.
You can't study it mechanistically and say, okay, I know exactly how God enters into this situation. I know how to do it. I know that it's a real signal for a variety of reasons, right? Like, you know, we look at a telescope and light coming through it, and we can say, okay, we have all these models of physics that tell us why this signal is real in this way. And so then that's where we end up with kind of the postmodern critique of like, how are we going to stabilize these systems of experiencing the world? Like there's this idea, there's this new age idea that all religions actually have the same core. And then therefore, if we kind of strip away all the dogmatism and the creeds, and we just search for the spiritual truth that's universal to Buddhism and Taoism and Christianity and Islam and Judaism, that we'll end up basically with the one true spirituality, and it's all the same. But it doesn't seem to me that it's all the same. I think that it's kind of a utopian dream that occludes a lot of information.
What do you think would be the thing that would, well, is there one thing that causes you to believe that that can't be the truth?
That they're all the same?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
it's like all the roads lead up to the top of the same mountain, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't think fundamentally that, I think something really profound happens when the sort of the pagan Western world becomes Christian. And if we look at paganism, and I actually think there's a lot of value to be recovered from the pagan perspective. But fundamentally, I don't think that it has as a highest value a form of love. And maybe that's starting to happen in Greek philosophy under Stoicism, and Plato's reaching for it, and Neoplatonists are reaching for it, but it's not what is the driver of Greek polytheism or Roman polytheism or Celtic polytheism, right?
Mm-hmm.
The child sacrifice, child sacrifice is like Carthaginian, but like, yeah, like Baal, the cult of Baal involves like people killing their children in order to get the gods to propitiate the gods, right? Like, this is clearly not the same kind of God that is conceptualized by Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a spiritual truth that, you know, there's completely contrary to. Now, Buddhism, to me, at least in its original thing, and to a certain, I think Vedanta is the same. I'm not 100% sure about that. But they both essentially are oriented to an idea that experience at being itself, self as a living thing is suffering or is displacement, and that the appropriate response to that is to try to move towards detachment from this experience of being to a state of something else, right? Like if you're a Buddhist, I think the original idea is that you actually just return to unity with the world soul, and then you escape the cycle of embodiment, which to me is to say that embodiment itself is something you want to escape.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Christian story, so far as I understand it, says God himself incarnates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He lays death, and he tells us that the world is going to be redeemed, that the kingdom of heaven will come here, and we will all experience it as embodied creatures, which to me symbolically tells us that redemption is an embodied thing. And to me, those two spiritual truths are completely at odds with each other.
That's certainly, yeah. I think it was it's either Peter Kreeft or Bishop Barron that I heard talking about that very thing just the other day about the beauty of embodiment. And Well, and that's the whole problem with Gnosticism, because Gnosticism wanted to go that other direction and say, no, 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 we got to get rid of the body. The physical aspect is evil.
And I mean, we see it throughout
the spiritual aspect. The
Eastern Church too, right? That there has been a lot of anti-body sentiment, right? Mm-hmm. Punish the body. Right? Mm-hmm. You know, it goes back to the Greeks too. I think maybe it was Epictetus who said we treat the body vigorously that it may obey the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like they're not different. Right? We can't treat them as separate things. They are continuous with each other.
Right? Well, but what you're really doing with your evolved move play is treating the body vigorously.
Yeah.
Not just treating the body, but treating the body vigorously, right?
And also joyfully.
Yeah. And you know, in the New Testament, it talks about increase your capacity so that you can run the race well, you know, beat your body so that it works. And when it says beat your body, it doesn't mean like flagellate yourself. Yeah. It means like the things that the Romans used to do when they beat their body was to keep their muscles supple and to keep themselves strong, right? Yeah.
Yeah, we do that.
Yeah.
But I treat my mind vigorously,
mm-hmm.
right? And I could also say treat my mind vigorously so that it can obey my body well, right? So that it can actually know the signals of my body.
Right? Yes, but I mean, the most recent research is that the best way to prevent mental decline is through physical activity, physical exercise.
Yeah,
absolutely. Weightlifting, walking, running.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But part of this is that we don't listen. We don't, like, we've abstracted ourselves to the point where we're not actually good at paying attention to these other aspects of the self. Right.
And you know, one of the reasons that I fall down on the whole aspect of physical capacity is that I didn't learn very well to listen to my body, to have my body speak to me. Now, my husband is completely the other way. My husband is 65. He could probably come on your retreat and outdo most of the young guys.
Mm-hmm.
He's just got immense physical capacity because he really believes that challenging yourself in every aspect is what's going to help you grow and stay young and all of that. Because he can listen to his body. If the littlest thing goes wrong, he can tell that he needs to up his game in some area. But anyway, before we go too far down this path, I wanted to go back to reasons why a person might believe that Christianity is true,
mm-hmm.
separate from all of these other beliefs. And there are two things that occur to me that I've learned over the years, and I believe they're true. And one is that there's certain things you can't say about Christ. If you believe that he is a good teacher and a good person, which I think most people from any tradition would agree with, even the Muslims would agree with that about him.
Sure. Muslims have great respect for
you
Christ.
Can't believe that. You can't believe that if he is not who he said he was, because the things he says about himself are so radical
mm-hmm.
that no normal human being would ever say that about themselves and be taken seriously unless it were true.
Yeah, it's C.S. Lewis argument, right?
Yes, it took me a long time to understand that, though. When C.S. Lewis said that, I thought, well, what's he really talking about? Because it sounds good as an abstract philosophical thing. But then as you read the Bible over and over again, and you begin to see Christ in the Old Testament, and you begin to see the things Christ said about himself in the New Testament, it just starts to become very clear that the things he says about himself are either true or he's not a good person.
Mm-hmm.
So the two things just don't mesh with each other. And then the other thing is I'm not a deep student of all the religions of the world, so I'm just going to say most religions have some sort of system of works that you need to do in order to achieve a certain level or become good enough for something. But in Christianity, you more have this picture of God acknowledging we are but dust and we are broken and wounded and needy. And he reaches down and transforms us and draws us up. So this reaching down is a completely opposite of us having to reach up. And to me, that's a huge distinguishing feature among all of these different pictures of reality.
Yeah, thinking about that. So a Buddhist entrains themselves to escape the cycle of lives. That's the, you know, there's many different strains of Buddhism, but I think that's the traditional thing. The a Taoist, right, in a similar way, is a set of practices for aligning ourselves deeper and deeper with the Tao. Islam, it means submission, right? It means that you act. It's an orthopraxic religion, right? It's about, you have to practice it.
It's five pillars. Is that right?
I think so. I'm not 100% sure. And then Christianity says, you know, that whosoever believes in Christ shall not die but have eternal life.
And that belief doesn't mean just a mental assent. I mean, it means a trusting, putting your full weight on the on this reality,
which is a mode of being. Yeah, I struggle with that because I don't know. I guess that's the eternal struggle in Christian thinking, is the balance between works and grace, right? And it's this idea that, like, if we are really accepted Christ, if we really, really have faith, that the works flows naturally out of it. Yeah, that's an interesting idea.
Well, I think I've struggled with this a lot because I look at myself and I think, why would anybody look at me and want to be a Christian based on me? When I first moved to California, I was working in a consulting company, and we were working with the interchange between Japanese culture and American culture. And these people had all been studying intercultural communications, and I was there because I had a certain amount of business background and I had lived in Japan, and that's all I knew. And so I got this job based on that, but I was not an intercultural specialist by any means. But here are all these people with all these beautiful soft skills that I didn't have. And so they were all gracious communicators, and, you know, on the surface, at least, they seemed like very kind and loving people and very disciplined. It was very disorienting for me because I had no way to differentiate myself at all. I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, well, none of these people are Christians. Most of them are Buddhists or having a lot of different belief systems. And here I am, and I'm supposed to be a representative of Christ. I'm supposed to be an ambassador of Christ in this community. It was very disorienting for me to try to sort through what that all really means. And, you know, there are some simple little crumbs that we have as Christians, one of which is, I am a beggar. I have found the bread. And I want above all things that others should also find the bread. Not because I think I'm any better or have anything more to give, but simply there is a source of bread. And the love that grows in me because I have been given that source of bread is to want to offer that bread to others. So it's a very small picture. It also keeps me grounded. I have no pretensions that I'm any better than anybody else of any stripe, except that there is a certain shape to reality. And the gift that we can be given is to have a desire to live in that reality. And to me, living within that reality has been a great joy in my life, not without suffering. There's been a lot of suffering. But that's always been one of my main complaints about Jordan Peterson, is when he says life is suffering. I'm like, no, not exactly. There is a lot of suffering in life, but life is a gift. And I think you have to make that differentiation if you're going to differentiate yourself from religious traditions that start from the ground that life is suffering.
Yeah, I think that I have the same sense. I think that I suspect that Jordan's personality is such that he has a, and he's talked about this, that he has a very strong orientation towards a negative emotion, right? He's high in neuroticism. And I think that that makes the idea that life is suffering particularly salient to him. I'm very low in trait neuroticism. I'm like first percentile in trait neuroticism. So it's not nearly as intuitive to me that life is suffering. I think I would say something more like life inherently involves suffering or struggle. That life is struggle, that we do not get to move through this thing without effort, without pain, without difficulty. But there can be joy in that, and there should be joy in that, and love. And ultimately, I think that's what I why I'm probably a Christian is because I believe that when we orient ourselves in love towards being, that that's the only way to experience being well, right? That we have the opportunity to love our experience of being more, and that it's a choice. It's and it is a kind of faith, right? My wife and I separated at the beginning of the year, and it was pretty traumatic, and it helped me a lot with my movement towards Christianity. But essentially, I just chose to have faith that if I continued to show up for her, as she needed, and that if I continued to do the work to take care of the things that had broken our relationship, that she'd be there, and that she would see the change in me, and that she'd want to come back. And that's what happened. Right? But it was like, there's no, I couldn't move from practice to faith in some sense. I had to move from faith to practice. I had to just take the relation, I had to take as given that I was going to have faith in this relationship, understanding that that faith might not result in what I needed. Even, but I assumed that even if my wife and I never got back together, if I had faith that it would repay in whatever way God chose for it to repay. And that's how it's played out. And
I
so
think
for
that
some
that's like so key. Because maybe we won't even see it in this life. You know, there are things that we do because we have faith that it is the right thing to do. And maybe in this life, we won't see it. I knew some missionaries years ago who went to Africa, and they spent like 35 years in this tribe, not only preaching the gospel, but teaching, you know, hygiene and doing medical services and teaching reading and helping people get educated and all of the things that they did. They never saw a single person come to Christ in the 35 years they were there, but they kept on faithfully serving, and they came back to the United States. And like 5 years after they got back here, another young couple had gone to take their place, and like a mass revival within that village, and all the people became believers and went out and started preaching the gospel to all the surrounding tribes. Well, it wasn't because these young people came in with some magic. This ground had been laid, and maybe those older missionaries might have died without ever having seen the fruit of all the work that they did. And that happens sometimes, but there is a bigger picture. I am not the whole center of the universe, you know.
Yeah,
And
there's many great artists and philosophers whose work is never recognized until after they pass.
Yes, absolutely.
It's gonna happen. It's gonna have an impact in the long run. You know, it's because it's right to do it that way. And so, in some sense, like for me, that's what I've been coming back to as we talk about this, is this idea of faith and works. It's like I can do the work to mend and heal my relationship with my wife because I chose to have faith that she was a really I chose to have faith that she was a loving person, right? And that she wanted the best for me, and that she wanted the best for our children, and she wanted the best for herself. And if I could show her that the best was going to be back with me, that she was going to see it, right? Chose to have faith that she wasn't motivated by, anything hateful. She was just hurting and scared, and she needed me to take care of what needed to be taken care of, so she didn't have to feel like that anymore. And in some sense, it's kind of like it feels like that's the way in which having faith in this all-loving Father above us, it prepares us to be able to do the right kind of work.
And to be able to have that vision of other people, to believe the best, to believe that the work is accomplished. Yeah, to believe that the work is accomplished is to move forward doing the work. And that would be another whole conversation. But I know you've given me an hour and a half already, so... So maybe this would be a good place to say goodbye until later. See you later on September 12th. Very much looking forward to it.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Take care. Have a
Thank
good day.
You. Yeah. Have a great day. Bye-bye.